The Irish Times Business Podcast in association with Irish Life.
We're here to support your company and your employees now and in the future. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life.
Hello and welcome to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock, a podcast from the Irish Times. Don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast for free on iTunes, and it's also available on our website, irishtimes.com/podcast. In the first half of this week's show, you'll hear about the latest revelations involving Volkswagen and its controversial testing procedures for diesel cars. In the second half of the programme, we have our monthly business and sports segment, co-hosted by Michael O'Keefe, Chief Executive of Teneo PSG. And this month, we're joined by Philip Brown, Chief Executive of the IRFU. First, we're going to start with the latest revelations in Germany about Volkswagen and its testing for diesel, this time involving monkeys and humans. Now, I'm joined on the line from Berlin by Derek Scally of the Irish Times, who's been following this remarkable story over the past number of days. Derek, you might just fill us in to the background on this.
Yes, it's about two tests that a lobby group financed by Volkswagen, BMW, Daimler and their major supplier Bosch. This lobby group financed two separate tests, one in the US in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the other was in Aachen in southwest Germany. The US test, both tests had something in common. They wanted to find out, they wanted researchers to find out what are the effects of diesel emissions, in particular nitrogen dioxide, on humans in the German case and on apes, monkeys in the American case. The American test took place in 2015. The German test took place in 2013. So this was in the final years before the Volkswagen Dieselgate scandal broke. And in this has caused outrage in Germany because the notion of testing on animals is always an emotive issue, but particularly the notion of testing on humans is completely outrageous in Germany because, for historical reasons, that in the early days of the Holocaust, the Nazis thought they could, rather than using poisonous gas, they tested exhaust fumes on people. People with mental and physical disabilities were put into vans and the hose was hooked up and the exhaust fumes were pumped into the truck. So we have, on the one hand, we have the Dieselgate moving into a next stage just when you thought it couldn't get any worse. And on the other hand, there are very uncomfortable echoes of the past. So this is the story, and what we've basically learned is that the head managers in Volkswagen and the other German car companies say they were shocked to discover this was going on. And what we've also learned is that these tests were very much an attempt by this lobby organization they financed to try and spin the notion of clean diesel. This is what they were introducing a decade or more ago to sort of as the environmentally friendly answer to transportation in the 21st century, clean diesel. We all know since the Volkswagen affair that that is a fraud, but they were looking for scientific information that would show that, yes, it's not just the car company saying this, we have tests to prove this is the case. And we know from leaks of the test on monkeys in the US that it was far from it, that actually older diesel cars were actually better for the monkeys' lungs than the new German diesels.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And it claimed a senior casualty at Volkswagen this week.
Yes, we had Thomas Stig, the chief lobbyist, basically, of the Volkswagen Group. He admitted he knew about the US tests. And he said, if I had my time over, I wouldn't allow that to go ahead. He has been suspended now. People have said people in Volkswagen say there's a big investigation going on, but he is the biggest head to roll so far. Environmental groups, including Greenpeace, have said this is just a PR stunt. They want more senior people to go. And they say, look, they're still conducting a basically open laboratory tests, an open experiment on the German population with cars that are emitting far more noxious fumes than is permitted under EU law. We also had Daimler has suspended its chief environmental officer. So this is once again, we're seeing we're seeing heads starting to roll on this. But of course, the question is, how far up in these companies does it go? If this was a crucial part of their clean diesel strategy, how likely is it that the chief executives of these companies weren't aware what scientific research was going on to back up their claims?
Okay. Michael McAleer, what impact has this had on Volkswagen reputationally and importantly on their car sales?
Reputationally, it's horrendous, but in as if to prove that the punters only really care about air quality and environmental issues when it affects their pockets, sales have actually increased. So it
sales of Volkswagen cars have increased since this whole scandal blew up.
So they're currently the best-selling car in the world. Even this year, their sales are hit 10.7 million. They're up 4.3%. Shares have risen, partly on the back of there has been a cultural shift within the company. So we're dealing with issues that arose under the previous management, but that's their spin. And as Derek has pointed out, a lot of people aren't buying into the fact that there has been such a significant change. The biggest question has always been who knew what and when, and those questions have not been answered by the company. And they continue to prevaricate over the and procrastinate over revealing the details of who knew what.
And this triumph of sales for Volkswagen, is it still of diesel cars, or are we talking about petrol or maybe hybrid or electric cars?
Well, they're still getting, they're trailing some of the other brands in terms of developing new product. They've committed to invest over 25 million over the next, or billion over the next while, to change their image and to develop electric vehicles and to take part in that whole drive towards electric vehicles. But certainly within the European market, diesel still plays a big part. The biggest push for Volkswagen Group and their 12 brands in the last while has been in China. The Chinese have never really got into diesel, so it has all been petrol sales. The clean diesel issue was a big thing in the US market. They wanted to crack into US sales where they were performing really poor. And they tried with this. They cheated. They admitted to it. It hasn't really hit their sales in the US market to any great substantial degree either. The focus has been then on renewing their message across the board. The company was micromanaged under the previous chief executive, Winterkorn, who was described at the time as North Korea without the labor camps by Der Spiegel. Under the new leader Matthias Muller, it has adopted this more openness of accepting ideas and a freer rein within the brands. But whether that has changed the culture within the company, it takes a long time to identify that.
Derek, has it affected VW sales in Germany? Germans took great pride in their car industry, didn't they?
Yes, I don't have the exact numbers, but I know from anecdotally that the diesel market has collapsed. I was looking at reports recently where German car dealers were saying they just cannot give diesels away. It's a time of transition here, and I think people are really starting to wonder, as I have a diesel, I still don't know what I should or shouldn't be doing, because Volkswagen is very much sending out mixed signals. In the US, it's mea culpa because they were caught. There are much tougher regulations in the US. In Europe, many people seem to think the attitude of Volkswagen is, well, go whistle. You know, they're their biggest concession to people in Europe, because there isn't the same class action possibilities, is, oh, you have a problem with your old Volkswagen diesel. Well, would you like to buy a new Volkswagen diesel? And that has annoyed many people, particularly because 2018 is going to be a crucial year in Germany, because in several German cities for years now, the level of pollution, particularly of nitrogen dioxide, which is this noxious gas in diesel fumes, has been well over EU limits. EU limits is 40 micrograms per cubic meter. In Stuttgart and in Munich and in Frankfurt and other places, we're talking 70, 80, measured regularly by special stations. And we're starting to see the first court cases. There was a court case this week in Munich. There's going to be others in Stuttgart, I believe, and in Dusseldorf. And the companies have been, critics would say the companies have been, had the politicians in their pocket for quite a long time, but the environmental groups are now attacking them. They're using EU law and saying, well, you can fiddle or claim your cars, you know, on the road or on the testing ramp. You can argue whatever you want, but the proof of the pudding is in the eating or in the breathing, and the air in German cities in many cases is filthy. So environmental law is going to catch up on this. With people unsure whether they're going to be able to drive their diesel to work in a year's time, and that's had a huge hit on sales.
By the way, Michael, do we have any idea of how Dublin, let's say, fares in terms of air quality?
Well, I think Derek is actually looking at some figures yesterday, weren't you, Derek?
Yes, I was. I mean, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, they have stations all around Dublin, and it's very much very interesting to look at. In some areas, I was looking in Ringsend and in Rathmines, there's definitely days when it seems that nitrogen dioxide levels spike well above the 40 micrograms per cubic meter. And what I'm not sure is how many days you can have a spike before you suddenly have a problem. But again, Dublin isn't Stuttgart. Stuttgart is a big city, sure. A big car town. They make the cars, they drive the cars. But what we're seeing is just this. There's a huge cultural shift. And if it didn't come through legislation with politicians, they've been very wary of pressing German car makers to actually do physical upgrades. So it's just a matter of, you know, people are voting with their feet or with their cars.
But one of the things is that the politicians led this policy to a certain extent, because the car companies were developing petrol cars. Europe seen the diesel move as being a way to crack into petrol driven markets and to push the CO2 emissions. So the focus and from the political circles was on global warming and on CO2 emissions, and they were less impressed or less interested in air quality, and they've been caught on the hop on this.
Okay.
Peter Mandelson identified this some time ago whenever the Dieselgate story broke, and he said during the negotiations when they were setting standards, they focused so much on CO2 emissions, and they hoped that the air quality issue would trail behind, while the Americans were focused primarily on...
Finally, Michael, I mean, you're somebody who follows the motors industry very, very closely. How long more has diesel got?
Well, according to Minister Nocton, 2030 in Ireland, he's suggesting that...
It's a long time away, 12 years.
It's not that long time when you think that the average car ownership is 9 years, so you might be only changing two cars between now and then. And if he was to introduce this ban on new cars, how he's going to finance it, how he's going to handle it is going to be a massive issue. Because the thing to remember is new cars are... You can swap and change policy with new car owners who are invariably the wealthiest in society. The people who are buying the used cars, the oldest cars, are the poorest in society who cannot take that hit very quickly. So you have to allow for them to change in a slower fashion, or provide them with incentives or support systems to make these changes. When we made the flip from engine size to CO2 back in 2008, what it did invariably was leave many people who had the longest commutes, who were stuck travelling the furthest distance in the oldest car, paying a lot higher taxes than the wealthier individuals in the suburbs who are commuting with their BMWs and their Mercedes.
Yeah. Okay, all right, we'll have to leave it there. My thanks to Michael McAleer and Derek Scally. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, IRFU Chief Executive Philip Brown will join us for the Business and Sports segment. Back in a few moments.
Only 29% of us know how much we need to live on in retirement. Irish Life is changing that with Empower, a new approach to company pensions that helps change the way your employees think about their future. For more, go to irishlifeempower.ie or talk to your pension consultant. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life. Irish Life Assurance PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. All information sourced for Irish Life, June 2015.
Welcome back. This is Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock. Let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free on iTunes, and it's also available on our website, irishtimes.com/podcasts. Now, for our monthly Business of Sports segment, I'm delighted to welcome Philip Brown, Chief Executive of the Irish Rugby Football Union, into studio. It's been 20 years since Philip first became CEO of the IRFU, and in that time he's overseen a period of significant change with the game moving to a professional status, Lansdowne Road being redeveloped to become the Aviva Stadium, provincial and international teams enjoying a lot of success on the field, and most recently Ireland bidding to host the 2023 Rugby World Cup. Philip is also well known in rowing circles. He represented Ireland at two World Rowing Championships and continues to have a volunteer involvement in that sport. Philip, you're very welcome to the studio. Let me just ask you about the Six Nations. Obviously, we're on the cusp of it now. Ireland playing France at the weekend in the first game. A big, important tournament, obviously, for Joe Smith and his team, and we wish them well. But tell us about the importance for the IRFU in financial terms.
Yeah, it's hugely important. It's effectively the financial engine for the sport here in Ireland. And I think the same could be said for Scotland, Wales and Italy, and indeed England and France. For us... The most significant part of our revenues are generated on the back of television rights that are sold around the Six Nations sponsorships.
And of course, TV3 have the rights now for the first
time. They have indeed, yeah. And so that's it's a new opportunity for us to actually deal with a new broadcaster. It's always traditionally been with RTE. So for us, we're delighted to have a new broadcaster in. It says something about the broadcast market in Ireland, actually, which is which is buoyant enough in sporting terms at the moment. But it's, listen, the Six Nations is huge.
Let's sort of try and, can we put some numbers around it? I mean, in terms of, what's the total income of the IRFU on an annual basis now?
Total income of the IRFU at the moment is in and around 80 million. Okay. And I'd say about over 80% of our income is generated on the back of the Six Nations. So it's that important. Between gate receipts, the sponsorship that we generate around our national shirt, which is with Canterbury at the moment as the shirt supplier, then you've got Vodafone, who are the shirt sponsor. You've got the broadcast rights, which are sold centrally through the Six Nations, and they're sold in the UK, in Ireland, and in France and Italy. But then there's a wider audience around the world, and those rights are sold as well. So there's a huge amount of revenue generated there. There's the sponsorship of the Six Nations itself, with NatWest this year, previously with RBS. That's hugely important. And obviously the gate receipts for us are part and parcel of that lifeblood, yeah, in terms of not only generating the revenue but actually getting people into, sure, the shop window.
I should ask you about that actually, because somebody, I mentioned to somebody that we were having this interview, and they said, God, you've got to ask them about the ticket prices. This person has tickets to the three games, three home matches, Italy, Scotland and Wales. I think it's €70 for an East Upper ticket for Italy and 80 for the Scotland game and 90 for the, yep, Wales game. It's pretty saucy, and it got them wondering whether they're going to have to shell out. I mean, New Zealand are coming for the Autumn Internationals later this year. Are they going to have to shell out 100 or more for those tickets?
Yeah, I think it's supply and demand, isn't it? And I mean, we've set our ticket prices. We look at the range of events that are happening in Ireland, in Dublin, whether it's concerts, whether it's other sporting events. So we don't come up with a price in isolation. It's, and we look at the market itself and what the market can bear and what we think it's worth. And to be honest, the proof is in the eating of that particular pudding. That we've had full houses last autumn. We've had full houses for the Six Nations as long as I can remember. And that's really important to us. It's not only about generating the revenues, but it's also about having a full stadium, because I think that
for atmosphere, yeah,
for atmosphere and also for sponsors, nobody wants to be playing in a half-empty stadium.
But what about for the New Zealand matches? Are we? Is there potential there for €100 ordinary stand ticket?
Very definitely. I think we haven't made any decisions on ticket prices, but I mean, New Zealand is probably one of the cachet matches in world rugby, and I think everyone would want to see an Ireland New Zealand match.
Just on the Six Nations, Philip, just in terms of the ability to grow and grow revenue, you said it's so important in terms of 80% of overall revenue. But where do you stand on expansion of the Six Nations, reconstruction of the Six Nations? There was talk of Argentina. There's now talk of bigger markets, and obviously with the TV money and sponsorship, you know, would you be in favour of maybe expanding the Six Nations or reconfiguring the Six Nations, do you think, longer term?
It's a good question, and it's pretty complicated in many ways. The first complication is, if you expand the Six Nations, where are you going to find the space in an already congested season, yeah, to play the additional matches? There has been talk about maybe you could reduce the Six Nations from a 7-week window to a 6-week window. Well, maybe if you left it a 7-week window, you could bring in another team and play more matches in that 7-week window. The reality is, from a player welfare point of view, that just doesn't stack up at all. And we certainly have been pretty vociferous about ensuring that we don't change that 7-week window with the existing structure of the Six Nations. The other issue is obviously that the professional game in Ireland, and indeed Scotland, Wales, and Italy in particular, is absolutely dependent on Six Nations revenue. So the notion of promotion and relegation is a hugely difficult one to actually absorb, because if you got relegated, effectively you could effectively destroy the professional game in one fell swoop in any one of those countries. So how do you deal with that? And nobody has the answer to that particular one. So it's been looked at. There's a second tier Six Nations, which is organised by Rugby Europe. You know, could we bring an additional team in? If we did, you know, would they? Could they come up? The top of the second tier could play in the Six Nations itself from year to year. But I think the big issue is for us is promotion and relegation, because it effectively destroy our financial model if you got relegated.
And on a slightly separate aside, we're on the back of what was deemed a very successful Lions tour as well, and not too many people might be aware of relationship between the the four nations and the Lions. Could you explain maybe perhaps how that works and maybe explain a bit of detail the revenue that's generated in the back of those and why a buoyant Lions is important for the RFU?
Yeah. The Lions is effectively owned as a brand by four shareholders who are the four home unions, as we call it, which is England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. And obviously there's a huge and long tradition of touring in the Southern Hemisphere. The curious thing is that the Lions don't actually generate a huge amount of money per se for the shareholders. What they do do is generate a huge amount of money for the country in which you are touring. Mm. And that's part and parcel of the whole economy of international rugby and the global season. If we didn't have Lions tours, the difficulty for the Southern Hemisphere would be they would be coming up here on an annual basis for Autumn Internationals, not seeing any of the revenues all coming to us. And there will be an imbalance or an economic imbalance in the whole system. So the way in which it's rebalanced is by the Lions Tour. So every 4 years we have a Lions Tour, and those monies go into the Sanzar pot, and that helps put a bit of financial balance back into the whole setup.
And just one last question for me, Philip. For now, is just on Rugby 23 and the bid that was, and I suppose we had Pádraig Duffy in here and John Tracy recently, and both were supporters of the bid and disappointed, obviously, like everyone that we didn't succeed. Where do you stand on looking at this again? You know, have you completely ruled out ever looking at a bid again? I know it's pretty soon afterwards to be making kind of decisions like that.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing we'll do is we're doing a review. The government are in the process of appointing someone to do a review. And I think, can we learn any lessons from it, from what we've done? And I think that's the first thing we need to do. I suppose there wouldn't be a huge amount of energy and appetite for rushing off and dipping our toe in the water again at this point in time. But having said that, you never say never. I think we put together a really good bid. I think the politics, the timing, possibly mightn't have been just quite right, and we had, you know, reservations about how the process ended up, which were pretty well published or publicised. But you know, I think Ireland is well capable of hosting a World Cup. I think that was acknowledged by Rugby World Cup themselves and World Rugby. I think we could have done a fantastic job. I think the popular vote amongst the broad rugby public around the world would have been they would have loved to have had the opportunity to travel to Ireland to a Rugby World Cup here. It's not to be. It's disappointing.
How much did it cost, Philip, to put that bid together?
It cost us in and around about $3.5 million.
Okay. And who picks up that tab? Is it the government or the RFU?
We've picked up a significant proportion of that tab, probably about half of it, and the government have picked up the other half.
Right, okay. Let's talk about the provinces a little bit. They've obviously, on the field, they've been successful over the years. Munster, what, two Heineken Cups as well, as and Leinster won three. And, you know, various other honours as well. They're all owned by the union, which is quite unique, unlike in France and England, where they're, you know, each club is owned by a separate entity. And we've seen huge money pumped into the game in France and England, and we've seen big powerhouses like Toulon and the Saracens emerge. It's made it very difficult for the Irish provinces to keep up and to keep pace financially with those clubs. Just wondering, maybe down the road, maybe it's 5 or 10 or 15 years down the road, is there going to come a time when the RFU will have to look at the ownership structure of the provinces in a different way and perhaps allow some external investment in?
It's a good question, and it's something that we are considering all the time. We've had workshops with the four provinces and the union, just looking at where can we generate new revenues and new business models. The reality is, well, the curious thing actually is that we don't own the provinces. Actually, the provinces own the IRFU. They are the four shareholders of the IRFU. So at the moment, the model works reasonably well. I think it's as good a model as there is out there at present. We don't have access to the same number of people with deep pockets that there are in France and England. But that's an unsustainable business model as well. I mean, the reality is it's only sustainable for as long as there's a queue of people willing to put their money into a loss-making exercise in France or in England. And that's the scenario. In England, we see there's at least two clubs or possibly three clubs up for sale at the moment. You know, a benefactor comes in and he spends 4 or 5 years and then he says, well, listen, I'd rather have a boat in the Mediterranean than have a club which I go to every 2 weeks. And so he shuffles off stage left and someone else has to shuffle on stage right with
It's a model we've seen in professional soccer in England, isn't it, for many, many years. But there always seems to be someone to come along. Maybe for different clubs, but there always seems to be somebody there.
It's a model, but I think comparing rugby and soccer, you know, they are two completely different sports in terms of scale and in terms of the sort of revenues that are generated and in terms of popularity. So, it's not really a sustainable model as such. In fact, the club game, by and large, around the world is sustained by the revenues that are generated out of the international game.
So how long can the IRFU and the provinces sustain the current model, do you think?
We'll keep going as long as we can. I mean, we are doing reasonably okay at the moment. We've taken a view that we simply can't pay the sort of monies that are available in France and England. And so what is our best way of mitigating that particular risk, the risk of players, flight risk of players going to England and France? Well, the answer is invest in the lower ends of the game in terms of making sure that we can produce a greater number of players of a higher quality more quickly, so that if the top players wish to leave at a certain point in their career, that's fine. Well, we have someone to come up and take their place. And we're beginning to see the fruits of that particular investment coming through, and that's David Nusaforo, Joe Schmidt have had a huge role in that, as indeed have the provinces, to be fair. The provinces have been great.
Particularly Leinster. I mean, they seem to be fantastic. A huge production line of talent coming through to Leinster.
On the pathway, though, Philip, just and one of the things that I suppose, not a direct criticism, but just an observation, is that the playing pool still remains relatively small, and I suppose a long-term strategic priority of the IRFU is to widen, I suppose, that player pool, particularly at kind of the minis and underage level, so that there's more and more. Obviously, there's more players playing, there's going to be more players coming through. What's your view on how the IRFU might, and I know there's been some work done already, but how it might go about expanding that away from maybe perhaps the traditional hotbed, which is the schools system, and to maybe bring more people into the game? Because rugby, as we've said, has never been more popular. TV audiences prove that, demand for tickets proves it, but to try and get the population playing wider.
It's not a problem which is just confined to rugby. The whole issue of recruitment and retention of players in field sports in particular is problematic for the GAA. It's problematic for soccer, and it's equally problematic for rugby. I think that one of the key things we have to do is provide different offerings. Not everyone wants to spend 30 weeks of the year playing 15-a-side rugby. There's a lot of people who would like to play 7-a-side rugby. Some people want to play tag rugby. Some people want to do blitzes. Some people would like an 8-week season. And so it's really about listening to what people want. And I suppose one of the challenges for a lot of sports is that they're generally administered by people in their 50s and 60s whose formative years were at a time when the sport and the format of the sport was quite narrow. It was 15-a-side rugby in a club competitions, and that was your social life, and that was your spare time spent doing that. Unfortunately, 20-year-olds this day and age don't think like that anymore. They have lots of other distractions. Yes, they want to be involved in sport. Yes, they want to stay fit. But they don't necessarily want to play the sport in the same way that we played 30 years ago.
I suppose that brings us on to female representation in the sport, Philip. And obviously, in the wider world that we're in at the minute, pay equality is high on the agenda, and female representation at the highest levels and boards and corporate land and so on is high on the agenda. What about for the IRFU? Because I was looking at your website earlier and looking at your committee, and I think there were 23 Blazers lined up on the pitch having a team photo taken, and there seemed to me only to be one woman as part of that 23. Now, maybe that position has changed since that photograph went up, but it seems like a very small representation of women, particularly when you're trying to expand the game in a playing sense.
I think it's an issue for a lot of organisations, is making sure that we're more inclusive, and particularly that there's a greater level of diversity on our boards. Mary Quinn was brought on, I think, 3 years ago onto the union committee specifically to try and address the issue. Our governance, as it is at the moment, is that we're a representative organisation, so we don't get to choose who comes to sit on the IRFU committee. It's dictated by clubs who elect representatives to the branch, and the branch elects representatives to the union. So there's an issue in there for us, in that we have to try and find ways of making sure that there's a greater level of representation of women, not only at union level, but also at branch level and at club level. And what we really need to do is try and encourage women to get involved in the administration of the game at grassroots level, and they will feed through into the system. In the meantime, we have to find ways and means of ensuring that we do have a greater level of female representation on the union committee. So we actually have a governance review in place at the moment, and it's an issue that is, you know, certainly very much in their sights, and they're going to hopefully come back with recommendations this year, and be interesting to see how they propose to deal with it.
It sounds as if this isn't going to change anytime soon. I just wonder if the government have a role in this, because obviously they provide funding to the IRFU at various levels.
They certainly do. Any organisation that is in receipt of government funding, any sports organisation in receipt of government funding, has to sign up to the voluntary code of governance. And so, you know, that's the road we're going down. So our governance review is going to have to deal with that and find the solutions. And it's a balance between being a representative organisation on one hand, and on the other hand, making sure that we have an organisation that's governed with an eye on diversity and equality.
Just on the professional system, Philip, and the players and so on, like, your tenure has kind of transcended that amateur to professional era and so on. How does it work when it comes to, you know, the contract negotiations with the big stars, and I suppose the role of agents, which has become, you know, very prominent now, and some guys represent themselves, but there is a kind of this emergence of an industry of agents who represent players, and I suppose what's your view on that?
Yeah, I've seen the change from the amateur game to the full blown professional game that we're in now. I think the first thing is that most players use agents now, and they do so for a number of reasons. One is they don't feel comfortable in dealing with their employer in a negotiation situation, and that's fine. I think there is a bit of a industry around agents, and it's obviously in some agents' interest to move players. Mm. So what we have, and we've worked very hard with the Players Association here, to put in place a set of regulations to actually regulate agents so that they behave in an ethical way and for the benefit of the players. And I think that has been a very useful exercise. And so it is changed significantly. I originally used to negotiate nearly all the contracts. Then we handed over a tranche of contracting to the provincial CEOs. And gradually I've pulled back from it, and really the negotiations are carried out in terms of provincial players with the provincial CEOs, and then with the players that are of national interest. David Nusafora obviously works very closely with the provincial CEOs in negotiating those contracts through.
Just on the players, because I suppose they're the first real, I suppose, professional athletes to live and breathe in this country, and you know, they, a lot of them have done very well, and fair play to them, and I think, you know, they've been national treasures and so on. But what has been the role, I think, how the IRFU has learned from maybe the first wave of professional players to the second and third wave, and maybe teaching players about careers after rugby? Some of these guys have gone on to have very successful business careers and are entering business. And I suppose, would you like to see, there's about three questions in here, sorry, would you like to see some of the superstars of maybe the golden era, the Ronan O'Gara's and Paul O'Connell, one day graduate into IRFU coaches and maybe of the national team?
Yeah, I mean, the way it's great, I was involved at the outset in terms of the Players Association. We recognised back in around 2000, I think, that in terms of negotiating with players on a collective basis, we needed a forum in which to do that. And we also recognised that we had a duty of care to players to ensure that, you know, at the end of a rugby, professional rugby career, that they simply weren't left in a situation where they had no way of earning a living and no supports and no mentoring or anything like that. So we have always been supportive of the Players Association. At times it may not particularly seem so when you read the media, but the reality is we have a close working relationship with them, and it's almost a joint venture between the union and players, this whole professional game thing. And the Players Association have an important role in that in terms of doing the things that would be difficult for us as the employer to do. So we help fund the Players Association. It allows them to bring in the expertise to provide supports for the players, whether it's mentoring, whether it's psychological support, whether it's lifestyle support, all of those things. So the players, we definitely are of the view that player welfare is, and the treatment of players in Ireland is one of the strong selling points that we have in terms of trying to retain players in the system. In terms of how has it changed over the years, I mean, we had... it hasn't changed that much, to be fair. We had players with, you know, I was talking with Keith Wood today about something, and we were just recollecting back in his day. And I mean, he was part-time, working part-time with, I think, permanent TSB at the time, and then became a full-time player. So that has all changed. What we, I suppose the real difference has been that we are now in, we have contact with players at the age of 15 and 16. And by the time they get into the academies, they're already well prepared for the professional game. And then we provide them with the, in the academy system, with all the supports they need to actually succeed in the professional game. So I think players who go into the academy system now have a much better chance of succeeding.
And I think the guys who are there now, I think, have come through the system, are getting good advice, good mentoring, good financial support. Yeah. I think the first wave of fellows who probably transferred from amateur to professional was probably more of a challenge because they were earning probably more than they had expected, and so on.
I mean, the downside is that, you know, players can become institutionalised, and, you know, there's always the issue of, you know, sudden injury and the end of their career, and they suddenly find themselves in a situation where, you know, every moment of the day was plotted out for them, and then they're no longer employed as a player, and now they have to fill it for themselves. And so there are issues. Nobody's saying it's an easy way to earn your living. It has its own challenges. Having said that, it's for a lot of the players, it's a wonderful way to. Mm-hmm. To be paid to do what you enjoy is a great thing.
Finally, Philip, there are Leinster fans listening here might be wondering when the RDS is going to be redeveloped. I know they've planning permission for the new stadium, but I don't think the funding's in place yet. And Connacht fans might be wondering when they're going to see a brand new stadium, maybe something akin to what Ulster and Munster have had in recent years. Can you shed any light on developments there?
Not particularly, other than it's as you say. I think the planning permission is there in terms of the RDS. Mick Dawson and the Leinster branch, obviously working very closely with Michael Duffy and the RDS. It's a funding issue, and I think if funding is available, and you know, I think it'll happen very definitely. Everyone wants it to happen. Connacht, obviously working away on their own plans. I haven't seen anything of substance yet, but they understand the challenges and the constraints of the sports ground, which is probably not ideal. Having said that, the investment in any stadium is going to be significant, and it has to stack up economically.
One highlight of your two decades at the helm and biggest challenge for the next few years?
It's got to be the Grand Slam in 2009. I mean, that was, you know, there's a lot of people who never thought they'd live to see the day that we pulled that one off. And I mean, it was absolutely fantastic. And you know, great tribute to the players, great tribute to the coaching. And yes,
were you hiding under your seat when Wales were taking that kick in the very last seconds of the match?
The fingernails were well gone at that stage, I can tell you. And I mean, the other thing which has been a highlight, I think, has been the way in which we have become a much more consistent outfit in terms of international rugby. And again, I mean, I was there in the 1990s where you could have a fantastic match one week and the next week it was the bottom of the bottom. And it's that has changed. We are a competitive rugby nation. And so that's been fantastic. In terms of what the future holds, it's really about going back to what you said, Mick, is, you know, we've got to grow the game, and in order to grow the game, we've got to have the shop window right, which is the professional game, and it's trying to find the balance between the two and make sure that we can have both living in peace and harmony. And it's a symbiotic relationship. You can't have the professional game unless you have the grassroots game, and equally, without the professional game, there will be no grassroots game, because this is the shop window and it generates the money.
All right, Philip Brown, thank you for joining us, and good luck to the lads in the Six Nations.
Thanks very much.
Now, to finish, Mick, let's do our business of sport wrap. Financial services firm Deloitte has once again released its Football Money League, charting the massive revenues of Europe's biggest clubs. Manchester United have pipped Real Madrid for a second consecutive year to retain top spot as the highest revenue earner, with £581 million in revenue last year, which might surprise some people because obviously they didn't win the Premier League. They won the Europa League, sure, yeah, but they were no great shakes last season under Mourinho.
No, and I think what this Deloitte report points to is I suppose the revenue generating power of the football club, not necessarily its wealth. So if you look at the top 10 of the 20, as you said, are from the English Premier League, I suppose United's revenue pulling power is based primarily on the power of its brand, its TV money, but also its overseas sponsorship deals. But if you were, there are other rich lists which would put the likes of Manchester City, PSG and others way ahead of Manchester United, who come maybe sixth or seventh in that league. So this is more a table based on the revenue generating success of the club, not necessarily its financial wealth. And you're absolutely right. The prize money that's associated with winning these things doesn't necessarily translate into where you come in this league either.
It's all about broadcasting rights. I mean, Brighton and Bournemouth, suddenly, you know, two small clubs in English football, but they're suddenly two of the wealthiest clubs in the world now, simply by virtue of the broadcasting revenue bonanza that's available to them.
No, absolutely. And we've discussed this a few times before. Like, there's obviously, and others have alluded to this, there's a very competitive marketplace when it comes to broadcast rights. You've new entrants to the market with all this disruption that's happening with the likes of Amazon and Facebook, which we've discussed before. If you look at only this morning, it was announced that BBC have paid over £200 million for just the highlights clips alone for the Premier League for the next few years. So, yes, I think the likes of the Bournemouths and Brightons, by the fact that they're in the Premier League, puts them into some of the richest clubs in Europe.
Yeah. Okay, let's stick with soccer on a slightly different scale, where the League of Ireland season is almost upon us, and Dundalk have been sold to an American investment firm. Peak Six, a sports-led consortium, has purchased all of the club shares, which will see current owners Paul Brown and Andy Connolly step down. Peak Six spokesman Jordan Gardner said that they've spent months assessing the opportunity and getting to know the club. Mick, have they lost their mind?
Well, time will tell, and like the League of Ireland doesn't have a great association with these kind of groups coming in and buying them as
the League of Ireland. I mean, it really is a backwater. I mean, the electricity SSE electricity league winners get €110,000 for winning.
But then again, I suppose the big prize is, even if you make the Europa League group stages as a Champions League qualifier out of Ireland, you're guaranteed somewhere between $6 and $10 million.
Twice in the history of the competition that's happened for
this is true, but twice in the last 10 years, I suppose. And I think the view would be that with enough investment that there's probably a 50-50 chance every year or even a 1 in 3 chance of making. And I suppose these people are investing the money based on that premise. I suppose what is interesting,
do we know how much they paid?
We don't, but what we do know, I suppose, in this one is that you could end up with superpowers within the League of Ireland, depending where this is going to go, whether it could end up towards the North Atlantic League, which has been discussed before. Obviously, Ray Wilson, who we know has put money into Shamrock Rovers, there's maybe potential there that they might become one of the three superpowers. Cork City, a big support base, and now Dundalk. I think Dundalk's big priorities are going to be reinvestment in their infrastructure. They don't become just another League of Ireland case study where it's a bust boom story, you know. So
yeah, okay. And finally, let's finish with the Super Bowl, which is coming up. You want to talk about this in particular?
Yes, I'm dying to talk about it all morning, actually. And yeah, just a couple of numbers just to bear in mind. There'll be over $500 million worth of money spent on advertising. 110 million viewers, Kieran, and 30-second ad costs how much?
Almost your
own salary, $5 million, Kieran.
For a 30-second ad.
Closer to home, though, we have the Dublin Racing Festival. 24,000 people expecting Leprosan. Big move by H. Ryan Leprosan there. We wish them well.
Yeah, not quite the Super Bowl, but anyway, we do wish them well. All right, Michael O'Keefe, thank you very much for joining us. Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Derek Scally, Michael McAleer, Philip Brown and Michael O'Keefe. Declan Conlon produced the show with JJ Vernon as sound engineer, and Dan O'Neill helped us with the research on the Business of Sport segment. Don't forget you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com, and you can also follow the Irish Times business feed daily on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care.